Star Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Hometown friends, serving your best banking interests in every way. Now, here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio historian collector Ed Corcoran.
Well, tonight, Dick, we get a behind-the-scenes look at network radio. We have with us Robert Metz, who wrote that bestseller, CBS, Reflections in a Bloodshot Eye.
And I have enjoyed reading this book, Bob. I want to tell you, it's a story, an aspect of radio that we have never touched before, certainly not on this program. And we'll be delving into the entire development tonight, Ed, of network radio. Bill Paley was 26 years of age when he arrived in New York, wasn't he, Bob?
He was so young-looking, as a matter of fact, that when he went to CBS, the company he was buying, to talk to the top officials, the office boy sent him away, figuring that no one could have business important enough to talk to the important men that he worked for.
Mm-hmm.
And the office boy was quite embarrassed when he discovered that he just turned his new boss away. The office boy is still there, by the way.
Still an office boy, too, I guess.
No, he's got a better job than that. No hard feelings.
What did Paley do about that?
What did Paley do about that? He didn't fire the office boy. What he did about that was go to his tailor. He was quite a wealthy young man, and have very severe-looking suits tailored, and he also got shirts that were very severe-looking, you know, in that era. As a matter of fact, he wore the same style suit, of which he had a number, day after day to the office, and everybody thought he had just had one. Because
mm-hmm.
He always wanted to look older than he did there in the beginning years, because people otherwise wouldn't take him seriously.
How did Paley become interested in radio?
Bill Paley was the advertising director for his father's cigar company, the La Palina cigar, made by his father. That's a variation of the Paley name, of course. And his father was a highly successful businessman and someone who Bill learned a great deal from. And when he finished Wharton School, where he studied business, of course, he came into the business there in Philadelphia and was made advertising manager. Finally, radio, which was just becoming popular, they approached La Palina for a contract to do a show on a local station in Philadelphia. It's the one that CBS owns there now.
WCAU.
WCAU. And while Bill Paley was vacationing in Europe, this advertising manager was finessed by his father and uncle, who took a contract for $50,000 worth of advertising. Bill Paley came back somewhat miffed, but in any event, he said, let's just see how this thing is going to go. His father got quite nervous because of the amount of money involved and didn't think there were going to be any results. But as it turned out, radio pulled extraordinarily well. And as a result of that and later contracts on the network, the La Palina cigar, at a time when the cigarette was becoming immensely popular, the La Palina cigar managed to go contra trend. They built their business on the basis of this radio advertising. They had something called Rolo and Dad, which is an early soap opera, and they also had the La Palina smoker. And it was a period of great excitement about radio. And Bill Paley, of course, the more he watched this thing, the more exciting it seemed to him. And cigars, a rather dull business, were not particularly exciting. And after a period of years, his sister married one of the principals of WCAU, a man named Leon Levy. Leon and his brother Ike, who was a lawyer, quite a feisty guy, just died about 3 months ago. But Ike and Leon got interested in the network that had been set up in New York, something called the United Independent Broadcasters, by Arthur Judson, a concert impresario. So Judson, always out of money, finally turned to his the people who had affiliated with the network for help. And Ike and Leon bought into the network and along with a bridge builder in Philadelphia named Jerome Lockheim. And when Jerome Lockheim began to tire of it, he'd had an injury, broken his hip, they turned to their friend and now Leon's brother-in-law, Bill Paley, and said, would you like to get involved? And he said yes, and the Paleys bought in, and the rest is history, as we say.
You know, the advice that he received from his parents, from both his mother and his father, I think is rather interesting, indicative, too, of the philosophy of the family. His mother said, shoot crap now, not when you're 50. I think something to that effect.
Well, that's what Ike Levy's mother told him when he was about to buy into WCAU. Bill Paley's mother presented him with a manservant and said, look, never do anything for yourself. Someone else can do for you. Bill Paley came to New York, and in his early days, he took a trip out to see the Warburgs, the investment bankers, for the weekend, and they lived quite simply. And he showed up with his chauffeur, with his car, and this manservant was really completely out of place. But his father gave him advice somewhat similar to his mother. He didn't say, don't do anything that you know, for yourself that someone can do better for you. He said, hire smart men and listen to what they tell you to do. Now, Bill Paley was a smart man in his own right, and this was one of the great things about Bill Paley. In the early years, he could listen to suggestions. He had no concern about the fact that maybe someone else had a great idea. If it was a great idea, he was tickled to death to get it, full willing to give credit where credit was due, and just anxious to make this whole thing go. And it was an extremely exciting thing. Just imagine if you, in this age, were the first company to try to set a satellite up around the world. You know, a manned satellite,
mm-hmm.
a private company, and you were the first. Can you imagine what an exciting thing that would be? I mean, there really is no precedent. There's nothing. There's no tradition. You don't have to worry about the fact that you may be stepping on somebody's toes or worry about inter-office politics. You're running your own show, and you're starting something entirely new. I mean, a network. Here you are in New York, and you're sending out great opera singers. You're sending out popular musicians. Comedians and so forth across the entire nation because you've got to tie in through telephone wires with every station in your network. And you're deciding what the people in this nation are going to listen to in the early years of radio. Very exciting thing for a young man not 30 years old.
That's right. Where did the name Columbia come from?
This happened because at one point in the early career of this thing, before Bill Paley came along, by the way, Arthur Judson, again, as he often did, needed money, and he made a deal with the Columbia Phonograph Company, which made records. And Columbia at that time was very much concerned because its major rival, the Victor Talking Machine Company, had made a deal with RCA, and they were afraid that radio would finesse a substantial part of their market as people listened to the radio rather than records themselves. They were really getting very much concerned, so they bought into the United Independent Broadcasters, and after two or three months, it was so costly to them, and they could see that they were going to lose a lot of money with this venture, that they were ready to sell out for a few hours of advertising time. And that's what they did, and for some reason, they allowed the United Independent Broadcasters, which had already announced itself as Columbia Broadcasting System, to keep the name. And then it came full circle many years later when Columbia Broadcasting System, through the good offices of Ike Levy, by the way, bought Columbia Phonograph Company, and that has become perhaps its most profitable subsidiary.
Mm. Yes, very good. Well, when we got to New York, there was a single station, but how did you branch out, or how did they branch out into affiliates? What was the basis of forming a network to do this coast-to-coast coverage you referred to?
Radio Corporation of America set up a pair of networks. It was obvious that technically it would not be difficult to pipe programming material from one central location out or out across the country if you had the telephone wires. And this did not go through the air, by the way. It did go by wire, you know.
And still does.
Still does.
Yes.
So General Sarnoff, General David Sarnoff, who was the top man at Radio Corporation of America, wanted to sell radios, and he felt that the radio would be more popular if the programming out in the countryside was first rate. And so he was anxious to follow through on this network concept. Meanwhile, the stations out in the woods were crying for programming material. They could play records, they could have local talent or whatever, but they found it wasn't very popular. People would say, well, I don't want to hear John speak about his old boat again. You know, I've heard that 100 times. They wanted central programming, top-flight entertainment from New York and California, wherever. Cincinnati was a major center, as you know. What happened was they offered the network service to these stations and made it attractive to them by paying them to use the material that they sent out. They got paid in turn from advertisers. So the concept of having a national network became intriguing. Arthur Judson, who was to be the top programmer for the two NBC stations owned by RCA, the Red and the Blue Network, went to Sarnoff to get him to go along with his prior promise to let him do the programming, and Sarnoff said he didn't remember having said any such thing. And that's why Judson, furious that he'd been let down, he furiously went out and tried to set up his own network. And that's what happened. Judson kept his stock even after he got out of the active management of the station. It was worth many millions of dollars at the time of his death. That was only 3-4 years ago. As an aside, I might say that I think I undertook this book just at the last possible moment to speak to some of the real pioneers in radio. Without Arthur Judson, but particularly Victor Ratner and 3 or 4 others who were very important in the early years and quite articulate and with great vast memories, it would have been extremely difficult to write about the early years of CBS.
One of the old men of the organization was Ed Klauber, who I believe Ed was 40 or 41 at the time, which shows you the age of these executives in their 20s and early 30s. Now, what was his background and what role did he play?
I should add, I thought you were going to, that Ed Klauber was the old man of the organization.
Yeah.
And just a little over 40. Ed Klauber was a difficult man. He had been the night managing editor of the New York Times, and he was married to a young woman, much younger than he, and he wanted to spend more time with her. He loved his wives. He had two, and they were both quite young and much younger than he. And he wanted to spend more time with his wife, and he wanted to get away from night work. So he was talking with Edwin Bernays, who is from this area, as you know, he lives in Cambridge, Mass. And Bernays hired him away. And Klauber got him a job, as a matter of fact, in an advertising agency for a while. And Klauber was such a difficult personality, they didn't want him. So Bernays brought him into his own organization, and in a small organization that Bernays ran, he was too difficult. Bernays was in public relations. So Bernays told Bill Paley that Klauber was a difficult man, but somebody he thought that Paley could use. Well, Paley was looking for someone to open the mail. He wasn't looking for an assistant. But he brought Klauber in, even though he had a very bad experience with him in that short period that Klauber was at the advertising agency. And Klauber immediately took charge, turned out to be a marvelous executive. As I say, difficult personality, but a marvelous executive. And he also, more than any other man, influenced the course of news on radio. In fact, he's called the father of broadcast journalism. He brought the standards of a great newspaper to radio, pushing the advertisers out, because the advertisers did have too big an influence on radio news up to that time. And he said, we're going to do our stories, we're going to do our news on the basis of news judgment and not on the basis of what our advertisers would or wouldn't like. Later on, people who carried out this feeling and philosophy of Klauber fired men who deviated from that standard.
Yeah. Robert Metz is our guest. The book is CBS Reflections in a Bloodshot Eye, published by Playboy Press, the story of the Columbia Broadcasting System from the very early days, 1927, to the very present. William Paley, a very, very interesting man, because although he was the head of a network, it required a chance statement at a cocktail party for him to realize that he didn't know anything about programming.
Mm. At this cocktail party, there were some influential people, more influential than Bill Paley, who was still young and just getting his feet wet in the business. And they were talking about this and that, and someone said, what about such and such a show? And Bill Paley reportedly replied, well, that's on my network. I know about the show, but I have never heard it before. And some, you know, very strong personality said, well, Mr. Paley, you just told us something very interesting about the broadcasting business, and it turns out you don't even know its principal product. And that gave him pause. The more he thought about that, the more he realized that this man was right. So from then on, he always had his ear to the radio, listening. try and find out what people wanted to hear, what people were listening to, and what attracted them. He wanted to know how well the show was doing all the time, and he was took a very, you know, serious interest in what was going to be on that radio. He still today wants to know what's going to be on television. He's the last authority. He makes the final decision as to whether or not a particular show that has any, you know, question mark over it, he's the one that decides whether or not it's going to be on. And that's always been his strength, and it is probably the most important factor in his success over the years. Second only to, I would say, his managerial expertise or his knowledge of people who do make good managers and his ability to hire them.
Well, another very strong personality figures in CBS, Frank Stanton, the ace and the king of the network. How did he come into the picture?
Frank Stanton came into the picture in a Model A Ford.
That's a good question.
He was down in Columbus at Ohio State, where he had been a professor, and he had written a rather extraordinary survey of listener habits on the radio, and this kind of thing was grist for the great CBS mill in those days. They established a leadership image by taking such material and using it to figure out what was going to happen to the radio listeners' tastes and so forth. So a man named Paul Keston, an extraordinary man at CBS, the promotion chief, a genius, saw this study, and he wrote Frank Stanton, said, if you come to New York, I think we might have a job for you. So Frank Stanton came up. He was young and inexperienced and very unsure of himself. And he worked into the CBS organization at $50 a week, and over the years became more and more influential as people recognized his great gifts. I'll tell you this one little story. One time, Bill Paley happened to be in the same elevator with Frank Stanton. He said, what are you doing over there in your department? And Frank Stanton pulled out a handful of 3x5 cards, and he says, well, on Project A, we're doing such and such and so and so and so and so and so and so. Took another card and says, Project B, we're doing such and such and so and so and so. More than Bill Paley ever expected to hear. And he had to be impressed with this man who was always so extraordinarily prepared, always had a rundown of where he stood on every project. Ultimately, Frank Stanton, with a man of considerable talent, rose to the top and became president. And after he reached the number two spot at the company, there was this relationship that I describe in the book as a love-hate relationship, because Paley recognized that this man had extraordinary talents and was strong where Paley was not so strong, and was a great counterforce in the organization, and a man who had a great sense of public relations, how to put the best foot forward in the network. There almost was never a fumble when Frank Stanton was there. If the network got in serious trouble, Frank Stanton just seemed to know how to handle the matter. Later in his career, there was a bobble or two when he was dealing with a major personality, Edward R. Murrow. But he was extraordinary at this kind of thing. And he was extraordinary in giving the impression that CBS was the great company in the business. It's always had that reputation for many, many years. It is the Tiffany of the three networks, and it retains that reputation today. But, of course, there's bound to be rivalry between men of great talent, especially when each would like to be the top dog. Of course, Bill Paley always was and still is, so there was no problem from his point of view, but he constantly felt that Frank Stanton was right there. And it's interesting, whenever Frank Stanton was in town, Bill Paley used to come to the office earlier than he did when Frank Stanton was out of town.
You mentioned Murrow, Egbert Roscoe Murrow, in Seattle, Washington, where his family moved soon after he was born, a man who had an acting background.
Oh, yes.
And who used it to great ability on the air.
I often think about Edward R. Murrow as sort of a man who could have played, I think, much the same kind of role that Humphrey Bogart played.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had extraordinary talent, and he got into broadcasting quite by accident. He was going to be he was doing talk show things in New York at CBS. He would find out who was coming to town, say the Prime Minister of Great Britain or whoever, and try to get him to come and do broadcasts. And he began to get involved in news to a degree this way. And the thing is that Murrow is one of the few men who went into broadcast journalism who did not have a newspaper background.
Mm-hmm.
He just happened to be the best there was, but he did not have a newspaper background. And yet he just had an extraordinary news sense. And he had a dramatic flair, as you mentioned. He went to London and he started reporting early in the war, or when the war clouds were beginning to gather. And he'd get on the air and he'd say, this is London. And he got a letter from his old drama coach out in Washington, and she said, Ed, you'd be more effective if you'd pause between those words. And that led to his famous tagline, or his famous introductory, "This is London." Much more effective, much more dramatic. I've always said, I believe it as much as I believe anything, that any broadcaster who has that additional dramatic skill is going to be the preferred performer over the man who just simply is equally good at doing the news.
Well, of course, Morrow and Paley became fast friends during the war in London. Paley was over there for quite some time.
There can be little doubt that Bill Paley's relationship with Ed Murrow in London, in which Ed, who was the bon vivant and knew all the great personalities, the prime ministers, the leaders of the governments in exile, and so forth, you name it, he knew them, that Ed Murrow's influence in making these people available to Bill Paley, you know, they would socialize with them, led to an extraordinary relationship, and I think it's fair to say led to Ed Murrow's great career in radio and then television when he got back to the States, because he had this direct line to Bill Paley. If he had a problem, he'd burst in and say, "Bill, I want to talk about this," and he always had that entree. Later on, as the network grew into its enormous, you know, multi-industry level, became a billion-dollar industry, Paley began to think that, gee, I can't afford this kind of relationship with anybody within this organization. Frank Stanton hated it. He wanted to have, you know, channels, everything to move by channels, and he resented that key right to the top, that line right to the top that Ed Murrow had. And as Paley began to be persuaded that this was not in the best tradition of running an organization, and also was persuaded that Ed Murrow was difficult and did some very tough, hard-nosed broadcasts, Bill Paley began to move away from him, and ultimately he killed the show that came on every half hour, half hour every week, See It Now, and that was the one where Murrow built his greatest reputation with his confrontation with Senator McCarthy, taking the part of people who got involved in the McCarthy hearings and pointing out that they were being flogged by a demagogue and that sort of thing. This kind of broadcast is where Murrow, I think, reached to his greatest heights, and ultimately Bill Paley decided to take him off of that kind of thing on a regular basis.
Well, there was another giant of that era, not as well known, but at least to the public today. That was Elmer Davis, who actually got a high spot in the government as a result of his CBS experience.
The thing about Elmer Davis that's interesting is that when I said that Ed Murrow had a great dramatic ability, in the back of my mind, I was thinking about Elmer Davis because he had this Midwestern twang, and when he spoke, he thought he was terrible. but there was something about that. You know, it's a funny thing about acting or drama. That certain peculiarities of the voice sometimes add to one's charisma. Tell me why Joseph Cotten, for example, has always been a popular star. He has the most deadening delivery of any major actor that I can think of, and yet he's always been a popular star, an effective star. Look at Gary Cooper.
Yep.
You know, all this kind of not very exciting delivery,
right.
And yet there is a charisma that goes behind it that makes for a certain drama. And this Elmer Davis had. But what he really had, and the thing that made him so famous, in a very short period of time, by the way, he was only on for a while before the war, in a five-minute spot that CBS carved out of important network time to give these stories just leading up to the war, he could do 30 stories with a comment in 5 minutes. I've known guys who worked with him. They said, it's just phenomenal the way this guy could put a story together and say, in Washington, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and so-and-so. And that would be the story. He'd say what was happening, and then his little comment, and go on to the next story. He could do 38 of those in a five-minute period, or three and a half, really, with commercials.
Well, one of the most interesting things about post-war CBS was the so-called Great Talent Raid of 1949. Mm-hmm. That was a real milestone for the CBS. Could you tell us a little about that happening?
Once again, we're talking about Bill Paley's extraordinary ability to pick the best programs. Well, if you can't beat them,
you join them.
get them to join you. what Bill Bailey did was at a time when the great taxes of World War II, they said there was a feeling that they ought to soak the rich during World War II, and the tax rate got up to 91 cents out of every dollar you made after a certain level. I think it was $70,000. Every dollar after that was taxed up to 91%. And the entertainers, of course, worked very hard. And with this kind of tax rate, if they were paid in salary, they couldn't really keep a lot of money. They could keep a lot, perhaps, as we and you and I would see it. But they didn't keep as much as you would expect. If they made $250,000, for example, with those high tax rates, they might wind up with, say, $70,000. That'd be all they'd be able to keep, or maybe 75 or 80. But in any event, so what they would do is they'd look for a way to avoid the tax, and there's just no way. If you have it, you can find tax shelters. But if you're earning it, you can't. So what they did was Bill Paley went to them and said, look, Mr. Benny, I'd like very much to have you on my broadcast. You do a good, clean show. You're very funny and wholesome. There's nothing I'd like better. And he said, frankly, I don't think anybody cares where you are on the dial, whether you're on NBC or CBS. If they know it's Jack Benny, they're listening for Jack Benny. They're not listening to CBS. They're listening to Jack Benny. And if we have you, we'll be all set. You know, we'd love to have it. So what they did was they offered Jack Benny a deal. They said, we will buy Amusement Enterprises Incorporated, your company, and we'll give you lots of money for it, and then it will only cost you a certain tax on a capital gain, 25% of what we pay you. So they said, wow, I'm going to keep 75 cents. I get some real keeping money here, you see. Jack Benny was impressed. He was a good businessman. He wasn't the stingy man he made himself out to be. He was quite generous. But when Jack Benny heard that, he was very excited. And he said, I'll not only do it, but I'll bring over my friends. And one reason he did it was because he'd never met General Sarnoff. General Sarnoff didn't care enough about Jack Benny to try to see him. And also, whenever Jack Benny went to the NBC lot, he had to pay a dime. And when he took the thing, he said, I wonder if they have pay parking at CBS.
Oh, dear. And that was part of the deal. He didn't have to pay at CBS.
He didn't have to pay. You know?
Well, the Giants did come over, and perhaps at this point, Ed, we might listen to one of those early broadcasts from 1949.
Okay, and this was, I say, the very opening night, the very first time that these people were heard on CBS, and I guess one who remained a big star for many years is Red Skelton. So let me hear how he sounded that night, Dick.
Well, here I am. CBS, this must be the place. Yep, there's a big sign that says, Tide presents Red Skelton. Tide. Tide. Boy, all I got to say is it better be good this year or Tide's in and Skelton's out.
Gee, Red, it's good to see you. Let me take a look at you. Gosh, you haven't changed a bit.
Yeah, well, okay, put me down, will you? You look good, too, Rod.
Well, I feel good, too. I've lost a few pounds.
You mean you have investments in England? Hey, I hear that every afternoon at 4 they serve tea and half-pound cake now. I went over to England this summer. I wanted to see what the American dollar looked like. Neat stuff on you, didn't it, huh?
Well, how do you feel about going to a new network?
Well, I'm a little nervous.
Well, you're always nervous. You should see a psychiatrist.
Oh, you kidding? Anybody who sees a psychiatrist ought to have his head examined. There's a brilliant remark.
You're not really that nervous.
I'm not, huh? Last night I put my pants to bed and I hung over the chair all night.
Well, okay, I'll help you dress.
Yeah.
Where do you keep your shorts?
In the third drawer.
Clean shirts?
Third drawer.
Your suit?
In the third drawer.
Well, how can you keep all your clothes in one drawer?
You're married. Stop asking silly questions.
Well, come on now and get dressed. You know, you promised to stop by and pick up the 4 nights.
Oh, yeah. Did you know that they're going to night school now?
No. What are they studying?
Hydramatics.
Hydramatics?
Oh, no. Yeah, they're studying hydramatics.
Hydramatics?
Yeah. That's in case anything goes wrong, they'll know how to shift for themselves. Well, come on, let's get down to CBS. My car's stacked up in the backyard here.
Okay.
Hey, Rod, you sit in the back. There's more room.
Okay.
Hey! What's the matter? Oh, thanks. I've been looking for that oil can for a month now.
Hey, do you know how to get to CBS?
For sure.
Okay. Uh-oh. Here comes that nasty old neighbor of mine, that Mrs. Fussy. Let's get out.
Mr. Skelton! Mr. Skelton!
I'm sorry, I can't talk now, Mrs. Fussy. I'm on the air.
That, Mr. Skelton, is why we can't get rid of the smog in Los Angeles. Your jokes are lousing up a metropolis. I don't know what connections you have, but if the truth were known, I'll bet you a vice squad telephone that the only way you ever got on CBS was through Mickey Cohen.
Miss Fussy, look.
Mr. Skelton, I don't have to take that kind of talk from you. And would you mind standing in the shade? The sun is over my house, and you're getting some of it on you.
But look,
I'm warning you. If you get a tan from my son, when you peel, you'd better give the skin back to me.
Oh, really, now,
Don't you ever stop talking. And another thing. While you were gone this summer, I found some of your aunt taking sugar from my kitchen and putting it in a hole in your yard. Oh, how sneaky can you get? My husband Jessup were only here.
You had a husband?
Now, what kind of a slurring remark was that? You don't think I could attract a man?
Oh, sure you could. You got everything that a man wants. Muscles, mustache. You know, I think I'm winning her over.
Red Skelton, on that very first night of the big talent raid when the great ones moved over from NBC to CBS.
1975 has been a year of growth for two hometown banking friends and neighbors who have now joined together to better serve you. During this year, the Cromwell Savings Bank has joined with Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank to offer even greater convenience to customers at any one of their six locations. An account at either bank is now an account at both. This means that these two hometown friends can now serve your best interest in every banking way. In addition to a number of savings plans designed to suit your individual needs, personal loans, home improvement loans, personal checking accounts will also be available starting January 1st. So stop in soon and apply for your personal checking account. The Cromwell Savings Bank division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has two convenient locations at the corner of Main and West Streets and the new Cromwell Plaza office near Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics has offices in Middletown at Main and College Streets and also on Washington Street. Other locations include Montville and Colchester, member FDIC and equal housing lenders. As 1976 approaches, they look forward to providing even better service to you and your family. Now, once again, back to Dick Bertel.
Our guest is Robert Metz, the author of CBS, Reflections in a Bloodshot Eye, published by Playboy Press, a best-selling book and a fascinating story, which we're sharing with you tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. And it's interesting to note that it was rather early in the game that Paley and Stanton became aware of television and what it would do to radio.
They found that this, by the way, I think is fascinating. The first television broadcast took place in about 1928 or 29. It was a little flickering tube, no bigger than, 7 inches, I think even smaller than that in the beginning. And there were regular broadcasts with Kate Smith. Mayor Jimmy Walker used to be on it, you know. The only people that really saw it were a few television executives, a few advertising executives. But in any event, nobody really thought that anything was ever come of it. But as the years went by and they made progress, it became more successful in terms of sending these broadcasts, and they found out how they could do it so that the picture would be hold firm and so forth, and that the people who were relatively close by would not get a lot of snow in their picture, began to get excited about it. And CBS, realizing that the television era was on the way, began to try to get spin-offs from radio. And they hired a guy out on the West Coast, that was a man who worked on him out on the West Coast named Ernie, this is awful.
Ernie's good enough. First name
is Ernie Martin.
Ernie Martin, right.
And the reason I couldn't think of it, I'll tell you why in a minute. But Ernie Martin began to take, radio shows and try to build them for television broadcasts. This was after he had worked into the organization, a young college student. He was very ambitious, and he had worked up during the war. He had a respiratory ailment and couldn't go into the service, and he moved right up through the ranks there at CBS and began to get some of these television shows underway. By the way, the reason I mention Ernie Martin is because if you know Fuhrer and Martin, the producers, finally Ernie Martin decided he wasn't going to get anywhere on television, and I became a multimillionaire in his own right by doing such shows as, well, you know, the
Charlie's
famous
Aunt.
Show, right? That was the first one. Charlie's Aunt was the one that took him away from CBS. They told him to either give it up or give up CBS. He said, I'll give up CBS because he thought it was more promising for him. But anyway, Ernie Martin was doing some of those early shows, and they were trying to find other ways to rob the radio schedule. And ultimately, they got Molly Goldberg to do her show on television. And they just had to spend a lot of money, lots and lots of money, which came out of profits, to build for television. And then finally, they got to the era where people began to watch it in the great cities like New York and so forth. And ultimately, they build a network there.
But the interesting story, I think, has to do with the acquisition of the property in California, which ultimately became Television City, or almost acquiring property that would have been relatively valueless.
There's a man out there named Earl Gilmore who ran a farmer's market, which, by the way, is still there. And he also ran a bicycle and motor track, all in one little complex there. And they needed, it was a highly successful venture, but it was in a location down, not downtown LA, but in a very good location that CBS had an eye on. They thought if we could only take over a substantial part of that property, we could build a wonderful studio. Earl Gilmore was quite a horseman, and he met with a man from New York who had done a lot of the real estate deals for CBS. And they met out riding someplace. And when they were riding on horse, they were on horseback when they made the deal to sell this part to CBS. And it was quite an extraordinary thing because no one ever built a television studio before.
Yeah, Arthur Godfrey, we've got to bring his name into this story somewhere along the line.
Arthur Godfrey is quite a mixed bag, some people tell me. He built, I guess, maybe the last great power empire for an entertainer. I don't think even Johnny Carson was in Arthur Godfrey's class. Arthur Godfrey at one time had three of the top 5 half-hours on television. That is to say that he had an hour show and a half-hour show, and the 2 half-hours and the hour show were included in the top five, as was the half-hour show. At one time, he was simulcast, radio and television, all these his talent shows and so forth. And he got involved with so much on radio and later television. I think that what happened to Arthur Godfrey was that he was so overworked and he needed to be so efficient that ultimately he overextended himself and began to get rather difficult to deal with. And finally he got into a major struggle with his vocalist,
Julius
LaRosa, mm-hmm. who many people felt was a very shy and rather retiring and bright and appealing young man. And that's why Arthur Godfrey chose him. And then when Julius LaRosa became more popular in terms of fan mail than Arthur Godfrey began to get a little nervous. They had a falling out, and there was this enormous thing on the air where he said, well, Julie, I see you're making lots of money doing all this nightclub work. And he says, you just sung your swan song. And Julius says, what's that? And that was the last time he was on that show.
Yeah, that's right.
He hired him on the air. And at the advice of Frank Stanton, according to Arthur Godfrey, he fired him on the air. And then the reporters began to go after Arthur Godfrey as being a man who was a little too difficult to deal with. And this is when his career began to slide into a kind of a trough. Then he had a very unfortunate illness. He had lung cancer. And he gave up his television shows because he didn't want people to watch him waste away. And when he came back, I think what has happened in the meantime was that television had grown up. And it had become a more sophisticated medium than it was when Godfrey left it to go to the hospital.
Well, anyway, let's talk in terms of Frank Stanton once again. Now, Ed, you brought him into the picture, and Bob, let's take him out of the picture.
Can we do that? What happened to Frank Stanton was he took himself out of the picture at age 65. He had hoped to become chairman of the company and was promised the job, he thought. And according to those who were there, Bill Paley was to step aside at a board meeting and become chairman emeritus several years ago. Instead, it became a non-event. The board of directors met. Bill Paley said nothing. All the press releases that were written were torn up, and a new press release came out saying that, you know, that Bill Paley had agreed to stay on as chairman. Agreed. I mean, he was the boss. He wanted to stay on, he stayed on. And Frank Stanton was desperately disappointed. He called television critics who he knew intimately and was almost in tears on the telephone, was in tears on the telephone. Bill Paley hadn't stepped aside. Several years later, when Frank Stanton became 65, he was vice chairman and Bill Paley was still there. And the very rule that Frank Stanton put into effect, retirement at 65, was applied against Frank Stanton. And he says, that's the only way I would have it. After all, you can't set up a rule and then violate it yourself. And he retired. However, it is 8 years past, or 9 years past, Bill Paley's 65th birthday, and he's still chairman of CBS.
Let's return to your collection, Ed, for another of those broadcasts from the great talent raid of 1949.
Well, let's do one this time, Dick. A former guest on the show and really one of the all-time greats, I think you'll agree, Edgar Bergen. Let's see how he sounded that night.
Coca-Cola brings you Edgar Bergen with Charlie McCarthy. Tonight marks the return to the air of one of radio's most beloved shows. Edgar Bergen with Charlie McCarthy, Mortimer Snerd, the Ray Noble and his orchestra, brought to you every Sunday at this time by the Coca-Cola Company. And now here is Edgar Bergen with Charlie McCarthy.
Hello, Charlie. What do you know?
Oh, my goodness. What a snappy one. Yeah. 8 months off the air to bring back something new to radio, and he comes out with, hello, Charlie, what do you know? Well, don't worry. McCarthy will save the day.
Well, fine. What have you got, Charlie?
Here it is, Bergen. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North America. Let's go to press. This is your Hollywood tattletale, Lujeta McCarthy. I always have a nose for news, but tonight I got a snootful. Ah, yes, there's good dirt tonight.
Yeah, now, Charlie, I don't think...
Splash, what blonde actress really is,
or...
That's rather good, yes. Exclusive. Margaret O'Brien is not the mother of Pat O'Brien.
Oh, Charlie. Charlie, just a minute.
It's the truth.
I know. Wait a minute. Is that what you intend to do on our new program?
That's it, Bergen. That's it, Bub.
Yes, well. You, a gossip reporter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why, you don't know what you're saying.
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. I read your lips.
Oh, all right. That burns a little, you know.
They're flapping like Monday's wash.
All right, Charlie.
Crash, open postcard to Hedy Lamarr. Dear Hedy... Yours truly, Charlie McCarthy.
All right. This is ridiculous. It won't do.
No.
Why, you couldn't keep up a gossip column every week.
No.
Well, of course not. Why, what would you do when you ran out of authentic items?
Well, Bergen, the less hampered I am with the truth, the better I work.
I know that. Well, there's no need to discuss it any further because we won't have any gossip on our program.
We won't, Bergen?
No. Those things are frowned upon.
Oh, they are?
Yes. You see that little statue on my desk over there of the three little monkeys?
Yes.
Do you know what they represent?
Your ancestors?
No. No, Charlie. Surely you know what those three monkeys are.
Win, place, and show.
No.
Hither, thither, and yon.
No.
Hart, Schaffner, and Larch.
No. No, the first monkey has his hands over his eyes. He does that so he will see no evil.
Is that so?
Yes. He can't see anything that's bad. I think that's nice.
Yeah. He can't see anything that's good either.
No. Now, the second monkey, he has his hands over his ears. Now, why does he have his hands over his ears? Why?
Now, you go ahead. Surprise me.
All right. So he can hear no evil.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah. Now, the third monkey.
Yeah, monkey, yeah, yes. Just can't get your mind off it, can you?
All right.
His brain is still on vacation.
All right. Now, where was I?
You were standing right there and laying an egg.
All right.
He has no idea where he is now.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am practically doing a single up here. Now, please.
The third monkey has his hands over his mouth.
You should be here with my top hat and monocle.
Yes, I know. Now, why does the third monkey have his hands over his mouth?
He's probably a Russian monkey. He's afraid to open his trap.
Oh. No, it's so that he can speak no evil.
Oh.
Now, I want you to be like those three monkeys, with your hands over your eyes and your ears and your mouth.
For that, I'd need six hands. You don't want a boy, you want a spider. Or a...
Charlie, my point in mentioning the monkeys is to show you the evils of gossip.
Yeah, well, you sure made your point the hard way.
Yeah. Well, at least I made it.
Friend.
Oh, my goodness, I believe it's a social twing. Yeah.
Simmer down. Flattery will get you nothing. Oh, hello, boss. Here I am, boss.
Say, why is he calling you boss?
Well, he collects gossip for me.
Oh, I see. So, Mr. Twing, you do Charlie's snooping and peeping.
Oh, do I?
Yes.
Oh, for heaven's sake, my gosh, do I? I've peeped and snooped till my peepers are poop.
Well, I've had some complaints there that you're a little too nosy.
Well, maybe I am, but I have lovely eyes to offset it.
Yes.
Well, now let's get down to business. Do you cover Hollywood, that wedding I told you to in Hollywood?
Well, as a matter of fact, I was a little late for the wedding, but I got there in time to cover the divorce.
Yeah. Well, good for you.
My gosh. The experiences I've had today, I became absolutely exhausted peeking into a keyhole.
What's so hard about that?
Well, I ran and ran and ran.
Why did you have to run?
Well, the keyhole was on a trailer. Goodbye.
Right.
Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, of course, and their first CBS broadcast for the 1949-1950 season as a result of the CBS talent raids on NBC. Our guest is Robert Metz, the author of CBS Reflections in a Bloodshot Eye, published by Playboy Press.
Old friends, hometown neighbors. Cromwell Savings Bank is now a division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. And together, they serve your best interest in every banking way. Open an account in either bank, and you have an account at both. And beginning January 1st, 1976, you'll get full personal banking service, including checking accounts. Join the family in the main office in Middletown at the corner of Main and College Street, at 846 Washington Street in Middletown, the Midway Shopping Center in Montville, Colchester Shopping Center, Colchester, 327 Main Street, Cromwell, or at the Cromwell Plaza near Kmart. In an age of expanding and changing bank services, Cromwell Savings Bank and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank have joined together to serve your best banking interests in every way. Member FDIC.
Well, Bob Metz, I want to find out a bit about the reaction to the book from CBS. This was not an authorized book, was it?
Well, it was sort of authorized until it came out, and then it was totally unauthorized. I was talking to somebody one time, and he said, you know, if you write a story about somebody, we were talking journalism, he said, if you write a story about a person and it's totally favorable and you say, balding Ed Smith. The only thing that Ed Smith will remember is that you said he was balding, and he'll resent that very much. I think, and others agree, that I have painted a portrait of Bill Paley as an extraordinary businessman, an extraordinary figure, not a great man perhaps, but certainly an extraordinary broadcaster, an extraordinary figure in broadcasting, an extraordinary figure of our time. Yet, in my efforts to present a complete picture, I've told some things about Bill Paley that he resents very much, including some things that you wouldn't expect him to resent, a man in his position. I've talked about the fact, for instance, that his Maserati Quattroporte is driven around Manhattan by his chauffeur, you know, and this was described by one of the people who loves automobiles who worked at CBS. Says that's like letting someone else be with your mistress, you mm-hmm. see. And Bill Paley resented the fact that I pointed out that someone else drives his special car. And in his memo, which he sent to every major newspaper and a lot of radio and television stations claiming egregious errors, over 30 in my book, he says, he points out that this is an error. Well, that's typical of the errors, you know. It's truth as reported to the gospel, you know, I mean, to the giver of all gifts. And I have come to the conclusion, since the book was published, and in view of Mr. Paley's inappropriate reaction, that what he needs today, more than anything else, is a court jester, someone to say, oh, come on now, Bill, you're being a little silly. He is so important, and so powerful that no one is willing at this point in his career to tell him when he's making an error, tell him when he's being foolish. And I think that there was no question about what he was very foolish about my book. I won't tell you I'm upset about it, because the fuss that he made got the book what I would like to call, you know, merited attention, and more people brought it perhaps than would have if he hadn't made such a fuss. So thank you, Mr. Paley, very much.
Well, it's been a fascinating story, and I'm so pleased, Bob, that you thought enough to share it with us here on the Golden Age of Radio. I might point out that you're with the New York Times, and I don't expect that you're planning to apply for work at CBS for a while, are you?
Nobody's been calling me up.
But read it. By all means, get a copy of CBS Reflections in a Bloodshot Eye, published by Playboy Press, by our guest, Robert Metz. And until next time, this is Dick Pertell.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
And his music.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Hometown friends, serving your best banking interests in every way. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bob Sharago and Dick Bertell.
Benny Goodman Swing School, the Tuesday evening rally of everybody everywhere who gets a lift from the new pulsating music of youth, swing.
The Lux Radio Theater brings you Rita Hayworth and Charles Corbin in...